Let's pray.
I think we should pray for people that aren't here. Becca and Jeremy and the boys, obviously, they're kind of not doing well this morning, I guess. At least Becca. Jeremy's playing Mr. Mom or what? Oh, nice, Grammy.
Yeah.
Grammy made the kids sick. Nice. Okay. And praise be to God for little Ethan. Sweet birth and cord that was long enough to not tighten things up and make it long. It was a good thing. Raising Seattle. Dealing with his mom. I don't know if you ladies, her mother-in-law, but they come to the conclusion that her heart's degenerating at a rate that makes it terminal. Again, so is mine, but again, here we are. I think, I don't know if I have longer or shorter, but so he's there with Jen trying to kind of break that news to her because it looks like potentially a fairly short time, year maybe. Jen's mom, they were going to talk to Helen this weekend. The doctors had said, but hadn't said something to her, I guess. So she's there. So yeah, let's pray. Thanks for bringing Lisa back this trip. Thank God for three antelope yesterday and start filling the freezer. It was a good day of killing. I'm not sure what Matt thought. We got a little Western, a little redneck once in a while, but we are. So that's right. God, I thank you. I thank you for answered prayer. I thank you care. I thank you for listening to our hearts and to our words. I thank you for safe trip down for Jean and Becky yesterday and the ability to share in the coming into this world of Ethan. I thank you for giving Levi and Jesse, particularly Jesse, a sweet birth of a little baby. That's got to be a huge distinction from last time and something that I'm sure she praises you for. Thank you for that. Thank you for bringing Ethan in safe. Thank you for antelope yesterday, time, more than anything, time together. Memories and things that we'll laugh about for years to come. I thank you for that. Thank you for bringing Elisa back, down and back. Thank you for sending some angels to escort her home when she was falling asleep Friday. Thank you for bringing the girls back safely. And we ask that you would impact them with what's truth and come against the lies and deception. I ask that you would protect, guard, intervene even in Jessica's time with Buck today. I know that she longs to give her heart away to somebody she thinks will guard it. That is not the state of things. So I should protect her in spite of herself. God, please give Ray wisdom to love on his wife, to meet his wife's needs, to be there emotionally for her, to cry with her, to consider the fact that life is terminal. I ask that you would soften Jen's heart to the point where she will be ache, she will hurt over death and ending of this time in this earth and realize the seriousness of it and the shortness of it and the urgency of what matters and what doesn't. God, I ask that you would teach us, because we are so utterly dependent on that. I ask that you would teach us in your Spirit, with your Spirit, in our spirits, the things that I think you want us to talk about today are not, again, culturally very acceptable or dealt with in our culture. I ask that you would help us to gain your heart so that our lives would be more in conformity with you, so we'd be able to be obedient, so we'd be moved in the direction of holiness, so that we could be intimate with you in our relationship. Thank you, Jesus, for allowing us the privilege and honor of sitting with God in our midst, because that's what he says. That's a holy and hallowed place of reverence and awe, causes to function and be that way and be cognizant of it. Amen. So, Matthew. Where's our buddy from Wednesday night? What was his name again? Kip. Terrible about names. I have to get embarrassed before I remember. Now I'm embarrassed, but now I remember. So. Kip. Said he was going to try to be here. He was asking about fasting, going off about fasting. Yeah. No, this he was Wednesday. And here we are. Here we are. I was thinking he was going to be here. I was about half smiling when he was talking about it. But here we are. Matthew 6. Jesus talks, again, I hope that Jesus' words are being impacted on us. I hope that what he calls us to and his explanation of the people at the time's religious understanding, which so often coincides with ours, we don't change as humans, we're fleshly, and fleshly responses to God don't take on a whole lot of distinction in their characteristics from year to year, from thousands of years. It doesn't matter. We're human. So our responses often to Jesus or to God and what God says and are parallel very, very much the people that he was talking to at the time. Jesus speaks very relentlessly about the thing that matters is having a relationship with God from the inside out, not from the outside in. But he also talks about the fact that a right response to God will cause action, that there will be action in our lives. In fact, action is demanded of us. But as Jesus always says, and as God says, action without a correct heart is worthless. Right? I mean, the comment is you've received your reward in full. In fact, it has no meaning in our relationship with God. Action coming from a right heart is obedience and has tremendous effect. Jesus is talking about not only having the state of our character, the state of our souls, or being in the correct place, but making sure that what comes out of that is also in conformity to God. He speaks in verse 2 of Matthew 6, and we're on talking about fasting, but he says, "And therefore you give alms, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is even doing, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you." When he talks about prayer, he says, go into your inner room, shut the door, and pray to your Father who sees in secret. And the The issue is that if that loneliness or that alone time or that the depths of our soul, if that's not the place that we're responding from, if we're responding from a place, and this is true, you know, we tend to respond. We tend to respond by our peer group and how the people that we care about, how the people we want to be esteemed by, how they feel about us. Very, you know, he starts off the chapter, he says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. How does that, there is a little bit of balance in that when he says, in verse 16 of chapter 1, he says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. How does that balance with each other? And I think it's very important. Number one, within the Christianity that most of us come from, the moment we say good works, we go, right? Because we're not under works, right? We're under grace. I'll state it again and probably relentlessly state it until God tells me otherwise, but be very careful. Grace doesn't mean that we're free to do whatever we want. Free will does not mean we're free to do whatever we want. There is good works that are supposed to come out of us. Okay. And the distinction is he says, let your light shine before men in such a way they may see your good works. And then in chapter 6, he says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Is that contrary? It's absolutely not contrary, obviously. That's easy for me to say because Jesus said it, right? But it's not contrary, right? The reality is that your life will produce. Unfortunately, the disconnect that the predominance of contemporary Christianity has is it says, we don't know, we can't judge, only God knows the heart. And God says, out of the wellspring of your heart, your life will show. Okay? God says your heart will produce. And we will know your heart by what your life produces. Okay? So, and it doesn't, the problem is what we do with it is in religion, we always come up with our own adherence to dogma that the judgment of righteousness or unrighteousness. And unfortunately, that almost is always distinct from, or very distinct, not from what God says, is what our understanding of righteousness is, what that righteous heart should produce in righteous actions. Again, we talk about, well, you don't say certain words and you don't drink and you go to church and you do these outward actions that we look at and go, oh, you must be. And you smile a lot and you say, my relationship with Jesus is great. And you do things that we tend to hold up as characteristics of a person who has a right relationship with Jesus says time and time again what that will look like. And predominantly, if you can narrow it down, he says, that looks like your life poured out for others. That looks like you regarding other people more important than yourself. That's what he says will be the way. Okay? And that doesn't mean that you can do a tremendous amount of giving of alms, right? He says when you give your alms, that's meeting needs. That's taking care of the needy, basically. Okay? You can do a tremendous amount of that. If the thing that you're looking for is validation for your life from other people, it's you've got your reward in full. That validation from other people. But what does God? God says, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. But wait a minute. He says, you know, let your light shine before men that they might see your good works. So how does that? How does that balance with beware of practicing your righteousness before men? Right? I think that it's, you know, I don't want to even try to give some cutesy little explanation or formula for that. Okay? I would probably feel much better about leaving you troubled by it. Okay? Because I think that should be, if it seems like somewhat of a dichotomy, it's not. Okay? If it seems like an irreconcilable dichotomy, that those two things don't match, that he's saying, speaking out of his mouth, this side of his mouth and that side of his mouth, that is not so. And I would ask you to, because I believe those two standards, Jesus holds those two standards up and says, judge your life by this. Right? Judge your life by this. So, and be very careful. Remember, one is right and one is wrong. Right? And so, the issue truly becomes, and I fear oversimplifying it, but the issue becomes, where does that come from? Who are you trying to please? That's the simple explanation of that. So when we look at how we, the things that we do in our life, what is our purpose in that? You know, it's very difficult for us when we grow up our whole life learning how to be accepted, how to gain assurance, how to gain affection, how to gain attention from the humans around us, and we order our life that way. It's very hard to transfer that. In fact, we tend not to do that when we supposedly become Christians, when we become born again. What we do is tend to whitewash that. What we do is tend to whitewash that same tomb, that same dead man inside, that same selfishness. We whitewash the self-esteem, the self-worth, the self-actualization, self-motivation. We tend to whitewash that with our Christianese language. We tend to whitewash that with our actions. I could go into a lot of responses that we have towards humans that instead of coming from a heart which is broken and contrite and is motivated by pleasing our Savior, we tend to whitewash our selfish actions, self-centered actions. And be very careful always to not judge selfish actions as those that look overtly selfish, okay? Versus those who look like they're just the nicest, sweetest person. Because it's much the same as, we talk about this among the men, it's much the same as a passive man. A passive man seems to be a nice guy. I mean, our churches are literally stuffed with them. For some reason, our churches tend to attract them even more than the world. Nice guys that everybody likes. They get along with everybody. You know, they speak nice about everybody. They have a big smile on their face and they make you feel good about yourself. A passive man is a selfish, dangerous man. Okay? All right. Are there distinctions in personalities? There's distinction in personalities. Okay? There's God made aggressive personalities, God made passive personalities. That's not what I'm talking about. Okay? What I'm talking about is a passive man is someone who cares more about how you feel about them than they feel about the state of your soul, or the state of your being, or your safety, or your heart. They care more about being liked by you than they care about the state of your soul, than they care about you. That's a selfish man. That's not a nice guy. Okay? That's a selfish, dangerous man that you could not trust with your back. You could not trust in warfare. You could not trust, and we are in a war. You could not trust with that. So, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be nice. Don't get me wrong here. We should all be kind and patient and long-suffering and gentle and compassionate and caring. Those are characteristics of every man and every woman that we're to have. But the oftentimes selfish, motives, internal heart motives, are cloaked in sweetness and kindness, niceness on the outside. Okay? That's not okay. That has no worth. You've received your reward in full. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be nice and we shouldn't be kind to each other. But we really need to understand that the only motive that is right is when I am alone standing before my Father. When we come to fasting, that's where we're at now. In verse 16 of chapter 6, it says, "And whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do." Now, again, hypocrites, we hate that word. You know, what's wild about hating that word? It's those of the people in our culture that are our heroes. Because a hypocrite is an actor. That's what it means. That's the word. That's where the word actor comes from, is hypocrite. Okay? And we tend to, think of hypocrite. Ooh, that's a bad person. An actor? Well, they're pretty cool, you know. I mean, I don't know who to say because I don't know them and I don't esteem them, you know. To me, it's a pretty dangerous thing that you have the characteristic to, convince somebody that you're an entirely different person than who you really are. I mean, there's a day not too long ago before they were making millions where that was called, before TV or movies, that was called a con man. Right? He could con you into believing that he was something other than he was. Right? Wasn't esteemed highly either, was it? No. You know, it was for selfish motives. Oh, well, actors don't do what they do for selfish motives, do they? I mean, unfortunately, I just want to be very careful because we tend to see hypocrite, the word hypocrite is such a strong negative word. None of us are. Okay? We would never be that. I mean, that's one of those really bad things. Doing it. But remember that when we can say that, but in our culture there is such an esteem for hypocrites. We hold them up as our heroes. I mean, who are the heroes in our culture? Action actors, you know? I don't know what you call them, you know? I don't know. The contemporary Bruce Willises are, or whatever, or Arnold Schwarzeneggers. I don't know who they are, you know. I know. That's dating myself, probably. But you know, they, I'm sure that there's contemporary action humans, you know, that star in action movies that are superhero kind of. We esteem them highly. We hold them up. You know, am I saying that's wrong? Well, I am saying that's wrong, okay? But the issue becomes, because just because somebody can pretend to be something other than who is, that's not who they are, okay? They are not superheroes. Don't get to pick up cars in real life. And in fact, most of them aren't even very nice people. Most of them are pretty selfish in doing it as actors. I mean, it's a phenomenal thing to look at the average actor's life. And if they even show some semblance, some tingling of humanity, we go, oh, look at them. They're going to adopt a child, you know? I mean, wow, you know, it's sad. Hypocrites are something we should be very, very careful to not hold hypocrisy up as something that we always reflect against. Okay? I mean, something that we always hold there to go. Because let's just say this, there is an element of hypocrisy in all of this. Okay? So, if I could say the thing that Jesus came hardest against in his ministry, if I could simplify that, I would say it was hypocrisy. It was the hypocrisy of the scribes and Pharisees. You know, Jesus made a statement at one point, I was reading the other day, and I mean, it was powerful. He goes, hey, I'm telling you, the scribes and the Pharisees are students of Moses. They know Moses. They know the writings of Moses. Do what they say. And I'm reading it going, wait a minute, Jesus, you're saying do what the... But he says, but don't mimic them in their lives. But don't follow their lives. Because they're hypocrites. Because they say one thing with their mouth when they speak the truth of Moses, but they don't live that way with their life. And That was the thing that Jesus came the hardest against in them. Wasn't lack of knowledge. You know, Jesus wasn't that they against people who didn't know the Scripture. It was against people who claimed to follow Scripture and didn't. One of the greatest points of hypocrisy that we should all question. What do we call ourselves? Every one of us in this room calls ourselves what? Christ-like. A Christian. A little Christ. Really? That's what we call ourselves. That's what we overtly proclaim ourselves to be to each other and to the world. And somehow we hold on to that as a badge of honor, but do we really consider where our boots are going because of that? Do we really, is that something that, or are we hypocrites? Are we really Christ-like? We want to hold on to that badge. We want to hold on to that name. Is that what moves our feet? Is that what moves our mouth? Is that what constrains us or motivates us and moves us to be like Jesus Christ? How can we call ourselves little Christ? How can we call ourselves Christ-like? How can we call ourselves and yet not have that continually be? What does that look like? What does that mean? How does what I'm doing, what I'm saying, how I'm acting measure up to that? Am I acting like Jesus Christ? Is my response to that person I'm driving next to like Jesus Christ? Is my response to my enemies like Jesus Christ? Is my response to my boss like Jesus Christ? We should be extremely concerned about routing out any hypocrisy in our lives. Okay? Because Jesus hated it. Jesus hated it. Because what it does, it tends to be a pacifier that conceals a wicked heart and makes us feel pretty good about ourselves because we get accolades from others. Who are making obviously a lot of money begin to think they're better than other people? Yeah. You know? Isn't that profound? Why? Because you have the ability to convince somebody that you're completely something other than what you really are? Because you played an action hero? That you really have greater value than other people? I mean, that borders on insanity to me. That you would really do that and really feel that way. But they do. Why? Because they get heralded by people for that. Because they get extolled. Because they get adored. Because they get worshipped for who they projected themselves to be. Not for who they are in real life. There's not too many people even in our culture that hold in highly esteem. I mean, there was some John Waynes that maybe had a lifestyle, or Roy Rogers that had a lifestyle, or, you know, some people along the way that had a lifestyle that was still honorable. That had marriages that were honorable. That were parents in a way that were honorable. That lived a life also that was worthy of esteem to look up to. But that certainly isn't the characteristic of most today particularly. Okay? They live very hedonistic, very selfish, very self-consumed lifestyles. And when they are not adored for how they are, they lose it. They commit suicide or marry somebody who will. I mean, it's a pretty perverse thing. We do the same thing. Okay? Do we base our value, our worth, our happiness, our comfort, our security on how we're being esteemed by the people around us? So, the propensity in us as humans is to do things which gain them. Which bring them. Okay? And in this case, he's talking about fasting. Right. So let me read it. And whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face, as the hypocrites do, For they neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you. I want to be a little bit careful. That fasting these days, I believe it's part of our propensity towards religion. We tend to say that there are lots of fasts. You know, we tend to say, I'm fasting from my phone. You know, no, what that means is no phone. That doesn't mean fasting. The word fast means to not eat. Okay, that's what the word means. Is to not eat. It's not talking about, I'm fasting from TV. No, the right word for that is no TV. Okay? Not going to watch TV. Good idea, maybe, you know? But that's not a fast. Okay? And the problem that I have with that, and why it's not just a matter of semantics, why I think it's worth seeing, is because what have we done? We've made fasting a religious act. Okay? So we say, if I'm doing this religious act, I can do it in many ways, right? I can fast from, maybe I just fast from ho-hos today, or from, you know, donuts, or I'm going to fast from coffee, you know, or I'm going to fast from whatever it is, okay? I'm not saying it's bad to go whoa when it comes to donuts or something, you know, right? Or coffee or something, you know, that's potentially a good thing. I'm not saying that's not a good thing. That's not fasting, okay? When it speaks of fasting, it means to not eat. And let's just say this. We really don't need to be like the Pharisees and just add 1,000 ways to fast, okay? 1,000 ways to follow. Because most of us don't even fast, okay? We don't need to add to it so that we, or work up to it, or do, if I have, let's see, if I have 100 ways to fast and I do all those, then I don't have to worry about it. Not eating, do I? Because I fast. You know, we're supposed to fast. And I fast things, you know. But fasting is not eating food, okay? Now, I'm not saying it's, you know, we need to say woe to our phone, to our electronics. You know, I think that it would be very good for us. I think we're beginning to talk about this. And I trust that God's going to shine his light down and kick all of our families a bit. We talk about it with the men. What does Sabbath mean? You know, what does a Sabbath mean? And we become pretty, I think we've become extremely wrong in our Sabbath understanding. Do I understand God's heart on the Sabbath? To be perfectly honest, no, I don't think I do. Okay? I'm sorry. Right? Because I should, and I should go after it. Do I rebel against the legalistic following of a day, of a certain day? I do. Should my rebellion blind me to what God has? It shouldn't, but it does, okay? I need to come against falseness, but I also need to be willing to accept the truth. And as we talked about in Thursday nights, and I will say this to you ladies too, and to us guys again, I am really confident that the Sabbath does not mean me time. Okay? Does not mean my time. In fact, I would say it means the opposite of that. And we as a culture have come to accept that our Sabbath, or our Sunday, or our day off of work is my time. I worked and I earned it. It's my time. I can do what I want with my time. God would be happy with me for honoring myself, wouldn't he? God would be happy for myself with me for doing what I wanted to do, right? I think that if we consider that, we'll realize, hopefully, because I believe it's God's heart, Sabbath is not about me and my time. Okay? The Sabbath was set of a day set aside to honor God. Okay? It was God's day. It was a day to not work. That doesn't mean it's me time. Okay? Because it's a day to not work. What does that look like? I think one thing for sure is that We live in a different era. This is not about us going slum to keep feasts and that makes God happy, or us killing an animal to atone for our sins, right? That this is about daily living, daily taking up our cross. And that's pertinent to the Sabbath too. You know, what does it mean? What is our priority in life? What do we honor? When it comes to fasting, again, the word for fasting is nestio, and it means nes is actually a Greek prefix that says not to. It means not eating. It was something that was practiced Jews, obviously, and some of those were given fasts. That God said fast on this day, Day of Atonement, being one of them doing it. It was days that were mandated, and then within their culture they fasted. It was an understood principle. I think much like meditation. Yeah? In spite of growing up in the West and seeing meditation as something that gurus and yogis and pot smokers do or something, you know, we are called as Westerners to meditate. Okay? By God, to do it. Okay? To think that the devil has a handle on it in all his forms, whether it's, I remember when I was in school, remember when we were in elementary school, they almost brought in, I know nobody wants to admit they were in school that far ago, but they almost brought in transcendental meditation. They brought in transcendental meditation into our schools, in our elementary school. Really? Yeah. Really? I mean, that is a tremendously dangerous thing. Is meditation good? Meditation is very good. The problem is clearing our mind while we're chanting a mantra, in which are typically demonic names, is a very dangerous thing. Real? Real! When mind and open your soul. All the aspects of yoga, in spite of the physical positive of it, are to get our body out of the way, to put our body physically in a state where it does not encumber the entrance of spiritual beings. The meditation on physical beings. Okay? That's what yoga is for, to get our body out of the way so that we're spiritually prepared. Okay? For the demonic. Right? Now, what do you say it's demonic, David? How do you know? Because it's not calling to Yahweh. Okay? And be real clear. If you're spiritually not crying out to Yahweh, there's only one other choice. I don't care what name he has. There aren't a bunch of good ones that are benign, that are second choices or middle choices. It's not like we have God and then there's a bunch of nice white spirits, white fairy tales, white something, and then we have black ones over here. No, we don't want the black ones. We just want the good ones. Okay. No such thing. There's nothing, we don't chant to call angels to come, to occupy our mind, to meditate, to focus. Okay? That's not the way God says it is, and it isn't. Meditation is something we should do, but the object of our meditation is everything. That's one reason why the memorization of truth, memorization of the Bible, has such a positive impact on us. Because meditate that, and I believe it's why God wrote a lot of the things in the Bible on more than a first grade level. You know? Jesus said a lot of things that were tough, that cause us to chew on them. Not understand them, but to chew on them and chew on them. I think he wants us to do that. In fact, I know he wants us to do that. Why did Jesus teach in parables? Because he wanted to be difficult. No, I don't think Jesus wanted to be difficult. I don't think Jesus wanted to hide truth. Jesus wanted us to meditate on truth. Jesus wanted us to make it our own, in a sense. Because we're of the nature, if we're if we're given the simple answer, it doesn't have a lot of meaning to it. It's like cramming for a test, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious. You go cram for a test the night before. It was my greatest nemesis, you know? Cram for a test the night before, spit it back out on the paper, and go away empty-headed. You know? Because that's what happens. You know? When you spend half the semester like you were supposed to, getting ready for it, learning it, studying it, writing papers about it, doing it, it begins to impact you, and you begin to change the way you think and goes deeper into your cognizance, into your thinking, into your mind, okay? And I think it's the same thing with the truth of God, that He doesn't just give us this, 1, 2, 3, you got it, okay? Because He wants us to go, I don't know what you mean. God, help me. Same reason for prayer, right? He wants us to cry, but God, I don't know what you mean. He doesn't want us to just, to go, again, go to 7-Eleven. In our prayers, right? Or what is it? Bell text, you know? In our deal. When we fast, fasting is important. And it's a difficult thing to deal with because we have a very sick view of food in our culture. And we don't want to deal with it. And we don't want to address it. And it permeates our churches. What is synonymous with church fellowship? Potlucks. Synonymous with church fellowship. Okay? I was thinking about that and thinking, so I looked up in Webster's potluck. Man, I've got a big Webster's, you know, like from 70s doing it. I don't know what half the words are in there. I've never even heard of them. You know, you're looking up a word and you're going, what is that word? What is that word? You know, I mean, we have not gotten smarter in spite of ourselves. Okay. In spite of our thinking, we've gotten dumber we've become less literate. But I looked up potluck. Does anybody have any idea what it might mean? Where the word came from? I, that's because I said something to you. So don't be cheating anymore. That's right. That's exactly right. We have a literate person here. It's good.
I got grounded at 10 from all books because I was 18 in the library. And my mother literally took every book out of my bedroom, except for the dictionary. And I've never seen.
Really?
So I actually read the dictionary from the book. And
it did some good here, at least, yeah? The word means what can be produced in the way of a meal for an unexpected guest. Okay? Or guest. What can be produced in the way of a meal for an unexpected... We tend to think of potluck now as... It's very closely associated with this sick feeling in us of gluttony, you know? Oh, gee, who could make something really good? Look at all this food here doing it. I mean, I miss. I think it would be good if we were more consistent in doing, and hopefully as when hunting season's over, we can be more consistent with potlucks, because I don't think we should necessarily call them that. Okay, I would call them more love feast is would be more really the word. Okay, because potluck's really not a potluck's a great word actually, but it's a sick word in our culture because it's a Christian word for gluttony. Okay, it's a Christian excuse for fellowship, and yet. I don't know how many of you guys grew up with church potlucks. Did many of you grow up with church potlucks? Yeah? No, the rest of you not really? At the well? And again, I'm not saying eating together is wrong. Don't get me wrong. I think eating together is a very critical thing. In fact, essential thing that we're supposed to do for intimacy of fellowship, okay? I think eating together is good. Potlucks are sick. Okay? I mean, the typical thing we have, Pardon me, it's a bunch of fat, overweight people having an excuse for gluttony. And everybody is checking out the desserts, you know, doing it. I mean, it has very little to do with fellowship. Okay? It has to do with, I mean, watch people. We had a several years back, right at the beginning of this era within this church, we all went to a retreat up in Chalice. Remember that, John? You weren't there. In fact, nobody here was there. Fine. So, Jeremy was there, Levi was there, Steve Martin was there, all the elders were there. It was sick, you know. This was, and the thing was, what was it called? It was called something about men being men, take command. What was that? What was the name of it called? I forget what it's called, but it was really the man thing, you know. This, we're going to have a man retreat here, okay? And so, sweet, you know, we're going to have a man retreat, you know. We're going to go up here. And so here's all these churches that come together from all over, and there was a couple hundred guys there. The only thing these, pardon me, and there's none of them here, so I'm not speaking about anybody in particular. There's nothing really excited these bunch of fat boys, but food that they fed. And it was literally disgusting to me. To see these guys, the most fired up they got was, oh, look at this, it's so good. Oh man, the food's so good here. It's good. What are we here for? You know, what are we here for? We're not here to excuse our gluttony. You know what the word glutton actually is? A couple words. Gaster. I'm sure that's where it's a Greek baseline that we get function of our stomach from, right? But the word, one of the word is gaster and one's phagos, but gaster is when it denotes a belly. Yeah, pardon me, John. Denotes a belly. Okay? I mean, it's also used for, in the context of a pregnant woman in the womb. Okay? But when it's used in the context, like in 1 Timothy 1:12, it says idle gaster, right? Is the word. Argos is the word. Argos, and it means idle belly. We in our culture, I mean, I realize, David, you're touching on sacred ground here. You can't talk about this. You can't talk about weight and being overweight and dealing with that. The Bible does. Okay? The Bible does. Okay? We're not overweight because we're undernourished and don't have enough food in this culture. We are overweight because we have so much food, so much bad food, so much badly processed food, so much, there's other types of, but typically the thing we struggle with in our culture, has more to do with gluttony than it just does our body type. It has more to do with, and we do all kinds of things to deal with it, you know, but the love of food is a dangerous thing, right? And fasting, I believe, is a very important check on that. Why do we struggle as a culture so much to fast? Okay, what is the purpose of fasting? I believe that there's manifold reasons for fasting. Okay, one of them, in the context of what we're saying, though, is just a check on your obsession. Is it check on our level of comfort that we get out of it? Of wanting to be appeased, of wanting to be satisfied, you know? It's no different than, you know, when we're bored or when we're doing something, we flip the TV on, you know, to do it. Or do we, you know, go get something to eat to make ourselves feel better? Or do we, you know, we have all these things in our culture because our culture is so full of very seldom is our first response to go to God. Very, very seldom, we tend to be more commanded directly by our stomachs than our spirit in our culture. And, I mean, we are very responsive to our stomachs, right? We will be obedient to our stomachs. Now, I would advise that at some point you're obedient to your stomach, okay? Because things won't go well after a period of time, okay? But remember when Jesus was being tempted? in the desert? When he'd just gone 40 days of head on with Satan, says he went to the desert to be tempted. It wasn't like he went there, was he preparing for his ministry? Absolutely. But he was there going in intense study. It doesn't say he took scrolls with him, so I don't know. But he was going out in the desert in precedence to him starting his earthly ministry. Open public ministry, right? I'm pretty confident the reason he went there is to get the devil interference thing dealt with. And that's why he went there. Okay? Because he knew Satan. Like, Satan. Not some of his boys, not some of his emissaries, not some of his demons. Satan was going, if this is really the Messiah and the King, I'm in trouble. This is not going to last for very long because I've read it too. Okay? And there's an end that's going to come here and I'm going to be thrown into the pit and locked up. Don't want this King. I think he was as confused as the Jews were. He thought that if Jesus was a Messiah, he would set up his reign on the earth, right? And he would overthrow and take all other rulers and all other kingdoms, and he would set up his from Jerusalem right there. He was going to set up and rule the world from there. Okay? Someday, I'm not sure if it's honestly even in Jerusalem, but someday Jesus will set up his rule on this earth, right? And at that time, Satan is in trouble. Satan's in deep trouble. Satan knew he was in trouble. If this was the Messiah, it ain't going to go well. So I don't want this to go down. Let me deal with this directly. I mean, Satan, he was there. He was there when the Magi came, you know, or maybe he wasn't. But some of his boys probably were, okay? And reported back and said, this isn't looking so good, you know? Maybe we ought to look and see what this says, you know, doing it, because they're saying this is the Messiah. And he does seem to fulfill this prophecy that's here. This looks up. By this time, Satan had followed Jesus enough. He knew who Jesus was and what he was about. Pretty sure. And Jesus was about to effect a 3-year ministry. And the devil was really going to be a pain in effecting that purposely. Okay? If he was going to relentlessly directly assault him. You know, as the prince of the power of this world. The average person can go 40 days. The average healthy person can go 40 days without food. There's the science of it. From what I understand, I haven't proven that. But it's the science of it. You have to drink water. Okay? The average person can go 40 days. That's a fairly consistent number, too. It's not based on difference in doing it. You can go 40 days. Well, actually, and at 40 days, though, you're in deep trouble. It's eating itself. Beginning to consume itself. You're shutting down. Your body's shutting down. It has no more fuel left to run on. It's not going to keep going. Okay? Jesus was at his weak. That puts you at a really, really weak state. Like, Jesus couldn't have walked out of the desert, probably. Okay? That's why angels came and ministered to him after it was done. Because he was done. Literally. Physically done doing it. But I believe it was going to that state of my weakest physical state in order to have this confrontation for Satan to realize I ain't going to get this done directly. It's not going to get done directly here. Because he hit him with his toughest things. What was one of the toughest three at the end of this deal that we read? If you are truly the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. Said, right? Nothing kind of weird, you know? I mean, and the truth is, would it have been wrong if he turned those stones into bread? No. The angels probably did something like that anyway. It says they came and ministered to him. What'd they do? Go to McDonald's on the way? You know? The angels came and ministered to him with food and ministered to him physically, all right? They might have turned the rocks into bread, okay? Was there anything wrong with Jesus turning rocks into bread? No. He multiplied 5 loaves and 2 fish and fed 5,000 plus people. Is that wrong? No, that wasn't wrong. They did it. What was the issue? The issue was, okay, you're at this place of desperate need. You need to eat right now. This isn't just, oh man, I ate 3 hours ago. I'm hungry. I'm starving. Okay? This was like, no, I'm starving. I'm really starving. Is there a need for food? Yes. Who am I going to follow? Am I going to follow my stomach? Am I going to follow? He says, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word which proceeds from the mouth of the Father. Right? What was the priority still in his life? Was it being obedient to his stomach and the devil? In the suggestion, in the inference, in the devil wasn't going to do it. He said, you turn him into it if you're the Son of God doing that. To his own ego, to his own flesh, to his own physical need. Was that what moved him and motivated him? Or was it obedience to his Father? This is his point. Man doesn't live by bread alone. I need to be sensitive and obedient to my Father in doing this. I mean, think about it with all of us. I mean, think about it myself. We are ultimately, intimately, immediately responsive to our stomachs. Right? I mean, what's that? It was really good, you know? But the issue becomes, and there's nothing wrong with eating the monkey bread this morning, okay? But the issue becomes, are we that responsive, that obedient to our spiritual? And I mean, do we respond to the Spirit even 3 times a day like we do our stomach or whatever? You know? Do we, and fasting is a physiologically it has positive benefits too, okay? That's a fairly known thing. I mean, we have a semi doctor guy, you know, doing anything, but, you know, is fasting, I don't know if he, because we don't deal with our culture, but it has positive implications from the fact that, physical implications, the fact that our body is not in the process of digesting food. Because that takes blood, and our blood can go to our brain. None of us can suffer from more positive brain function, you know. It has the ability to cause clarity. Any people that have fasted understand that once we get over our sick psychological addiction to food and struggle with it, I personally find that, you know, a day of fasting is when it is, or a couple days of fasting or whatever, the first few days actually are the toughest. Because you're so immediately responsive to these urgings that your body has. Even though in spite of the fact we say we're starving, we're really not starving, okay? Is it good to eat consistently? Yeah, I'm not saying it's not good to eat consistently, okay? But the thing is that once we quit, we get so enslaved by that. So ensnared by that. So held captive by that. And it's not just feeding sustenance either. Particularly in our culture, it goes way beyond that. There's a tremendous pleasurable effect. I mean, I'm really grateful we don't only have rice and beans to eat for the rest of our lives, okay? But there's many people that do, okay? And they eat for their sustenance. We tend to see, we're very creative. Well, I don't eat it. I just had that for lunch yesterday. I'm not gonna eat it again, you know? I mean, we have that capacity in this culture, right? We have that capacity to self-gratify, to get excited about, you know, what I'm going to do. I mean, you know, the whole restaurant thing is, I'm not saying it's wrong to eat out, okay? But, I mean, it's a major part of our culture that we go out and participate in hedonism. Okay? I'm not saying it's wrong to go out and eat. I'm not saying it's wrong to spend time with people. I'm not saying it's wrong to have that intimate time, because those things are very good to do. Very important. Sometimes it's a positive thing to let somebody else cook a meal for your wife. If you ain't going to do it, maybe you go pay to do it. Okay? And that's not a bad thing, okay? We do it once a year, whether we need to or not. But I would just ask us all, fasting has, this isn't, what we want to be very careful about is to make fasting a religious act that elevates us religiously, okay? What fasting is truly to be a response of our heart towards God and coming to a point of freeing ourselves from our addiction. Again, fast for a day. See where your head goes. See where your heart goes. See where your emotion goes. See what struggles you have. It's embarrassing. It ought to be truly embarrassing. I know it's embarrassing for me, and I don't really care about food much. Okay? And it's embarrassing. You feel, oh, it's lunchtime. Oh, man. Oh, no, I'm fasting. Oh, it's lunchtime. What could I eat? Oh, no, I'm not eating, you know? I mean, it doesn't, again, I don't really care about food. But we are so conditioned to respond to that, not even out of hunger, okay? Out of compulsion. Is that something, should we be? In living in an incredibly gluttonous society, and living in a, you know, it's a sick deal. If you go to church and you look outside and somebody's smoking a cigarette, and the church goes, oh, they're a pagan. That's a terrible thing. As you're sitting there salivating with your fat belly waiting for the potluck to start, that's a problem. Okay? That's a hypocrite. That's not okay. And we live in a culture that feels that way. Okay? Now, I agree. We're above that because we live in Sun Valley. And there aren't too many fat people up here, right? We don't have fat people like everywhere else. In fact, it's a pretty amazing thing. And don't get me wrong. That has nothing to do with health in this culture. That has to do with absolute self-absorption in this valley. Okay? That has to do with consumed self-absorption. Okay? In this valley. And the ability that we can buy very healthy food. We have the money to do it. And we can live a very healthy life. And I can go jog. And I have leisure time. And I can work out. And I can do all those things to make it happen. We're very arrogant and proud of ourselves. But you go to any other town around, if you spend time up here and get locked in, it's more shocking than, it's shocking to me. I mean, that I've lived here for 25 years now. I mean, you go to another town, you go, oh my gosh, is this really what America looks like? I mean, no wonder most of the world hates us. We do realize there's not enough food to go around, right? And there isn't enough food to go around. The way we consume it, we could feed the world, okay? If we really wanted to feed the world, we could feed the world, okay? But the way that things are set up now, there isn't enough food to go around. I don't know, what's the latest statistics on people who don't have enough food to eat? You know, we're looking at, it's a sick thing. We tend to, up here we go, oh no, we can't have big families. You're ruining the world. There's not enough food to go around. There's not enough. You're selfish and stingy. Really? Do you realize that the world is being overpopulated by people who don't even have enough food to feed their brain as a child and cause it to develop straight in third world countries? Who's really going to have? Of all people, we should be having children that are going to change the world for a positive. Because we have enough food to eat them so that they can learn and be smart and think outside of themselves, understand the world, understand the Bible, understand God and have a relationship with Him, and powerfully go out and have an impact on the world. It's a false reality we live up here. Okay? We're going to have small families because we're going to save the world. Really. That's what your lifestyle looks like? You realize that your food budget would probably feed 100 families in most places in the world for the year? I mean, we're a lie, and we live a lie. In that state, in that culture, in that accepted culture, it's not our right just to whitewash our lives. Okay? It's not our right just to dummy it down. It's not our right just to not buy dessert when we go out, so I'm going to sacrifice it or something, you know? We need to understand and look at our own addictions and look at our own compulsions. We need to look at our own discipline. I believe that the discipline of fasting is a very good one in our relationship. We tend to think that our relationship with God doesn't really entail discipline. It's based on when I want to. We are very undisciplined in our spiritual lives as a people. When I feel like reading my Bible is when I read the Bible, right? When I feel like praying is when I pray, right? You know? When I feel like going to church is when I go to church, right? Because it's based on, that's what God's relationship is, a feely thing, right? No, it's a discipline thing, too. It is, God is real. And our disciplining our own lives in order to more clearly pursue Him, would that be a good thing? And fasting is one of those. Fasting is one of those. Throughout culture, you know, Jesus said, when His disciples came to him at one point, they said, they were casting out demons, right? I mean, it's a wild ride. We should probably live in about the same wild ride, but it's a wild ride, okay? And they're casting out demons, and they came back to Him and they said, but there was one demon, man, he wouldn't go. They wouldn't go. You know, this person was controlled, was possessed by demons, and we couldn't do anything about it. Jesus, what's the deal with that? We don't understand that. And He says, this kind does not leave except by prayer and fasting. What's that mean? You know? But let me say this. The discipline pursuit of spiritual things. And if that, when that, does that mean physical? That means physical. Should we fast because we don't want to be fat because people think we're fat? That's not a good motivation. Should we care about our weight because of the way we look to other people? That's not a good motivation. Should we curb our diet so that we look like we're disciplined and we don't? Our lives are to be lived before God. And that is who we're to please. And that's who we're to care about. And fasting, I believe, is a very important discipline to have in our lives. What other serious self-denying disciplines like that do we have? And fasting means not eating, by the way. Again, discipline of shutting your phone off, that's probably a good thing. No phone day, okay? It's a good thing. But I'd ask us all to consider, are we willing to really put what we say with our mouth? I adore God. I love God. I honor You, God. You are worthy of my life. You're worthy of my service. You're worthy of my discipline. You're worthy of my suffering. We say those things in our life, and are we willing to put that rubber where the road is? I mean, I know some people in our culture, there's people potentially is a good thing. The money that they would spend that day in fasting for food, they tend to give away. Is that a big deal? It's not a big deal. Something. I think the consideration of other people, let's be clear about this. Someday we will be in heaven. And we will face our brothers and sisters from Bangladesh. Someday we will be in heaven. We will face our brothers and sisters from Uganda. We will face our brothers and sisters from third world countries who watch their children starve to death. And they're going to say, were we in the same fight? When living on the earth, we were to love each other as brothers and sisters. What were you doing? What were you doing? Let's pray. Jesus, you told the Pharisees when they questioned you. Actually, that's not true. I'm sorry. You told the John's disciples particularly, and your own disciples particularly. You told them when they asked, why don't you fast? Why don't your disciples fast? Why, like John's disciples did, and And it was a discipline of all spiritual people. He said, well, while the bridegroom's here, you don't fast when you're with the bridegroom, but soon we will fast. Soon we will fast. And it doesn't say if we fast, don't put on a gloomy face and wash your face and hands and do it to you. You say when we fast. And I realize that we can easily make that legalistic. I think you were careful not to say, well, you fast on every third Tuesday. Or as many of some of the Pharisees did, they fasted every Tuesday and every Thursday. And this is not a point of, if I do this, then I gain righteousness with you. God, I ask you to cause us to understand that self-discipline, not for the exoneration of the people around us, but applying that to our pursuit of you has eternal value. It doesn't make us righteous. It only allows us to gain in clarity, to gain in intensity, to gain in knowledge and understanding while we're in that fast, to gain death to the things that compel us and move us and determine our actions in the course of our days. The food becomes something we do for sustenance rather than fulfillment. I know that you give us days that are to feast, to celebrate you, to honor you, to be grateful. And that's not wrong. That's right. And it should cause us to glorify you and to be grateful for you. To you. But God, I ask that you would give us your heart, and not just on fasting, that we would not make things that you call us to religious, external religious things, like giving alms and saying prayers, all the things that you're talking about here. That we would understand that it is absolutely where things come from in our hearts. If our heart comes from a pure heart, if our heart comes from a righteous heart, if our actions come from a righteous heart, there's going to be fruit in our lives that's evident, and those are going to be our good works that people see and glorify you. But doing those works on the outside in order to gain validation for them has no worth. I ask that you would cause us to realize that the only thing that really matters is you who sees in secret. You who rewards our lives in secret with joy and peace and security and intimacy. There's no greater reward that we could have from you than intimate relationship with you. That is a reward beyond measure. And we should long to live our lives in such a way that everything is ordered to bring that intimacy with you. The fruit of that will be that we live as in love with each other. We can have love feasts. We can come together and celebrate intimacy with you and intimacy with each other. Fulfillment, contentment, peace, security, attention, affection. God, please challenge our hearts hard this week. Even cause ourselves to look. We live in a society which is consumed with food. Consumed with food. It's very hard to see your perspective in that. We just want to whitewash the worlds or our cultures, like all things. So, God, I ask you to cause us to be willing to see your perspective. I'm not sure what that looks like. And potentially there isn't a distinct formula. And it would be sad if we became legalistic about it. I thank you for the privilege and honor of serving you. I ask God that you would please move us, please move me to the point where I am compelled more by your Spirit than I am the gurgling of my stomach. Amen.